joined various membership programs for a monthly fee granting them access to various events and newly published books, or were print or digital subscribers. These monies now eclipse the Guardian's ad revenues. For those not wanting to see ads, YouTube offers Red for $9.99 per month. Many other platforms charge extra to be free of commercials. It is not uncommon to hear the argument advanced by entrepreneur Kevin Ryan, a founder of DoubleClick and Business Insider. Many could afford new subscriptions because they are going to Starbucks and paying $5 a day for a coffee. Maybe. But let's return to the economics. The New York Times subscriber base is expanding nicely, up by 46% between 2015 and 2016. They, like the Washington Post, have done a spectacular job puncturing the untruths and disarray of the Trump administration, and they've been rewarded with a burst of new digital subscribers. These subscribers have made the Times less reliant on ad dollars. This is great news, but, and here's the rub, the Times makes most of its profits from the print newspaper, including 62% of its advertising revenues. And it's not clear how a much cheaper to produce digital newspaper could generate comparable ad revenues. Why? The average reader of the print edition of the Times spends about 35 minutes a day with it. But the average online Times reader spends about 35 minutes a month. Because advertisers know readers spend much less time looking at their ads, they pay about 10 to 20% for the same online ad as appears in the newspaper. Despite the growth in digital subscribers and the rise of circulation revenues of 3.4% and the growth of digital ad revenue of 5.9%, the overall revenues and profits of the paper fell in 2016. This left the Times to caution about its future in its 2016 annual financial report. We may experience further downward pressure on our advertising revenue margins. By the end of the third quarter in November 2017, the Times reported that despite the further erosion in print newspaper revenues, overall revenues rose by 6%. Obviously, if the Times could one day abandon its print edition, the cost savings in paper, printing, and distribution might offset the disproportionate profits the print paper generates. Or if the Times can increase its subscription revenues from 60 to 70%, as it hopes it can, analyst Ken Doctor has written that the Times could escape from its struggle to maintain slim profits to generate actual lasting growth, ahead of inflation. Alas, Times profits in the years ahead will be slim. And like other smart analysts, Doctor knows that if the Times succeeds in maintaining slim profits, it will be an aberration, not a trend for other newspapers. The dominant trend was defined by Gannett's USA Today and its 109 regional newspapers, and chains like McClatchy and A.H. Bello, which saw their 2017 print advertising and circulation losses exceed their digital advertising and subscription gains. No question. Consumers can reconfigure their cable bundles and can make choices among various subscription models. But to believe that the bulk of consumers who live on tight budgets can afford subscriptions as a substitute for the ad dollars that subsidize most of our free media and internet activity is to ignore the math. Yet the conundrum is that the advertising ATM subsidy may also be unreliable. The thought many marketers try to banish is whether for consumers, spoiled by Netflix and YouTube, by ad-skipping DVRs and ad blockers, by personal devices we hold in our hands, the interruptive ad message may be a relic. Are consumers irrevocably alienated by sales pitches? Has the consumer, on whom marketing relies, become a frenemy? 19. No rearview mirror. 2 weeks ago, I skied down the mountain in Deer Valley, and it's the first time I didn't have a rearview mirror in a long time. Michael Kassin. Disruption has not always been kind these last several years to marketers, but it has been kind to Michael Kassin and MediaLink. By mid-2016, Kasson was ready to make some real money. He was soon to turn 66, and his sole other shareholder, Wenda Millard, was 63. Liontree's R.A. Burkhoff's exploration of a possible sale was heating up. By summer, Kasson confided that he had four bidders. He guessed that in any deal he would agree to sign up for another 5 years, and his company would command a sales price in the $150 million range, with performance rewards driving the price up from there. Burkhoff explored a range of possible suitors, including the talent agencies in Hollywood who had branched out as marketers, the advertising holding companies, the consulting companies, digital giants like Facebook or Google that were encroaching on the ad business, and perhaps a company in the events business that was eager to expand. "Someone asked me if I would be interested in buying it," Martin Sorrell says. He was not interested. He believed the natural home for MediaLink would be one of the consultancies. Kasson did have personal discussions with his friend Maurice Levy about being acquired by Publicis's consulting arm, Sapient. That idea was attractive to Kasson, for he was especially fond of Levy, and Sapient was competing with McKinsey and Accenture to offer strategic marketing advice to the C-suite. "In pure strategy," Kasson said, "we do make a difference." The problem working for an agency holding company or Facebook or a consulting company with a roster of clients was that MediaLink would have to shed its neutrality. How to conduct agency reviews of your parent company as a neutral? Financially, he might be willing to consider abandoning his agency review business because reviews are not a big percentage of my business, single digits. But they were a big part of his power. More than a few members of the advertising community thought Kasson's neutrality claims were a salesman's contrivance. "I choose sides," Rashad Tabakawala of Publicis says of Kasson, whom he has known for years. He was uncomfortable that Kasson did not choose sides. "There are two forms of Switzerland neutrality. You are neutral, or you sell out to everyone equally and everyone pays." Although he does not assail Kasson publicly, Martin Sorrell knows how to inflict pain. When Kasson attended WPP's afternoon stream conference during the 2016 Cannes Festival, Sorrell came over to Kasson's table at an outdoor picnic lunch and, loud enough for others to hear, exclaimed, "I hear you're selling your company." Kasson was horrified and enraged, but laughed it off. Late that night, he huddled with Burkhoff. By August, Kasson said he had an offer from an unnamed consulting company that he would not accept. Looking ahead, Kasson and Burkhoff scanned the field of possible suitors, assessing their pluses and minuses. With his friend Maurice Levy soon to step down as CEO of Publicis, and with the uncertainty as to who would succeed Sorrell, John Wren, and Michael Roth, all north of the customary retirement age, their stocks might be impacted. Vice-like cost pressures on the holding companies were tightening, driven by C-suite demands to slash spending, by fears of corporate raiders mounting hostile takeovers, and by poisonous and spreading mistrust between clients and agencies. Procter & Gamble would announce that over the next 5 years, it would slash its $10.5 billion marketing budget by $2 billion. Keith Weed's Unilever, which fended off a Kraft Heinz takeover assault in February 2017, would cut its agency fees by nearly 20% and the number of ads it produces by 30%, especially impacting its foremost supplier, WPP. Clearly, John Mandel's 2015 speech to the ANA and the K2 transparency report that followed had injured the agencies. When the ANA's annual report on agency compensation was published in May 2017, it revealed that advertisers were aggressively addressing transparency concerns and streamlining and simplifying agency compensation practices. Senior management involvement in negotiations with agencies, the ANA reported, more than doubled from 33% 3 years earlier to 73%, and agency fees were shrinking. In an offshoot of Mandel's kickback claims, by the summer of 2017, five of the six giant holding companies were also said to be in the crosshairs of the Department of Justice, being investigated for cheating clients. The justice probe allegedly centered on whether agencies, to fatten their wallets, engaged in bid rigging of production contracts by leaning on independent production houses they did business with to submit inflated bids for production work, allowing the in-house production arm of the agency to submit a lower bid and win the contract. By contrast, turmoil remained MediaLink's friend. The K2 report forced the agencies not to make money the way they used to, Michael Kasson says. He doesn't believe they were doing anything criminal. They were doing what their contracts allowed. However, motivated clients questioned their agencies more severely and amended their agency contracts. "We're in more agency reviews now than we were in 2015 and 2016, Kasson says. In the summer and fall of 2017, MediaLink would conduct agency reviews for Anheuser-Busch, Intuit, Lego, Mattel, and Subway, among others. At the same time, troubled agencies sought Kasson's counsel, as did newspaper and magazine companies, consulting firms, Facebook, Google, and many digital aspirants. Few companies escaped the turmoil. Although Les Moonves's CBS seemed in particularly good shape, its revenue sources swelled, its profits exceeded those of two decades ago. By the end of the 2016-17 season, CBS had been number one in prime time 14 of the last 15 seasons, and its stock price had soared. But there was no ducking the fact that it confronted existential threats. Live viewing is dropping, and one day the networks would not be able to charge advertisers more for less. The joke's going to be over at some point, Kasson, among others, flatly predicts. A hit show like American Idol on Fox in 2002 attracted a primetime audience of nearly 40 million viewers. A hit show like Empire on Fox in 2016 attracted one quarter as many. Even if delayed viewing and a swelling American population yielded comparable audiences for hit shows over the course of a month, advertisers knew that many fewer commercials were watched. What is declining is people watching the ads, Kasson says. Brands need to find another way to communicate their brand message. Plus, the young viewers advertisers craved were fleeing, many to shorter videos watched on smartphones where 30-second ads are a no-no. Primetime viewing among those under the age of 34, Nielsen reports, plunged by 34% over the past 5 years. And unlike digital television streamed over the Internet, which scooped up data on its viewers, broadcast television could only tell advertisers the broad demographics of who watched, but not supply deeper data on those who actually watched. By the end of 2017, Michael Nathanson of Moffitt Nathanson projected that total TV advertising would drop by 5%, which would include network as well as cable and station declines. Long term, Irwin Gottlieb believed the networks were making a potentially fatal mistake by selling their programs to video-on-demand competitors like Netflix, and that this would pose a future risk to advertisers. "There are two fundamentals that are impacting the television business today," he says. "The first is we are gradually training people to consume less linear content. You watch it when a network schedules it, and to consume more non-linear content. You decide when you want to watch it. That's a problem because television as a medium was initially built around the concept that you create a schedule and a promotion strategy that relies on people seeing the promotion at the right time. Nonlinear watching means networks need new ways to think about scheduling, and it will weaken their ability to promote their schedule, inevitably shrinking their audience. Second, viewing is moving from advertiser-supported content to subscriber-supported content. We have already passed the tipping point where subscriber-supported content can outbid the advertiser-supported channels anytime they choose to. This trend will have long-term implications. This is a huge problem because supply will go down because there are no commercials. That's a huge problem for advertisers, and it's a huge problem for legacy media. Mindful that content platforms like CBS and Disney were, in the short term, corralling huge profits by selling movies and TV programs to Netflix, while in the long term building up a muscular frenemy, Disney announced in August 2017 that it would cease selling movies to Netflix in 2019. In another potentially disruptive move, CEO Bob Iger also announced that it would begin streaming sports, including ESPN, and movies and TV programs directly to consumers, as Les Moonves had earlier promised for CBS's own streaming services, highlighted by the exclusive offering of a popular Star Trek series. Both were implicitly proclaiming that they were competing with Netflix. They were also, in effect, admitting they were competing against their cable distribution partners, allowing more consumers to potentially drop their expensive cable subscriptions and substitute cheaper, skinny bundles of Disney and CBS and other content. Whether cable distributors would continue to pay hefty retransmission consent fees to networks for exclusive content that was not exclusive invited a potentially massive and destructive future clash. Another possible short-term enticement for the network entered the mix in the summer of 2017, when Apple said it planned to spend $1 billion annually on TV shows and movies to compete against Netflix and Amazon. And both Facebook and Google also announced they would expand their original program offerings, aiming to siphon some of the $70 billion advertising dollars now earmarked for traditional television. If these digital giants seek to buy network shows, once again Les Moonves and his network brethren must decide whether to take the easy money and risk strengthening a frenemy. If Apple, Google, and Facebook aim simply to launch original programs targeted at younger audiences, it will take them years to amp up. This battle awaits another day, perhaps after Les Moonves is gone. In the meantime, Moonves is not following Disney's lead in yanking content from Netflix. He has received deserved plaudits for his skill at diversifying CBS's revenue streams, which were projected to rise over the next several years. Standing on the Carnegie Hall stage for CBS's upfront presentation in the spring of 2017, Moonves glowed as brightly as his purple tie. Despite the speed of change and the many challenges, he told the audience, in this fragmented world, the social and economic value of any medium with the power to bring people together is more important than ever, and that's what we do here. Great content is always king. Carolyn Everson was equally bullish as 2016 came to a close. She had just turned 46 and was entering her seventh year at Facebook, a year that would see Facebook reach 2 billion monthly users. Google and Facebook were gobbling up 77% of every new global advertising dollar. Everson believed the measurement travails of the fall were history. In the year-end diary she privately composes each year, she wrote, "Our business has exceeded all expectations, and we are trusted by the industry as to who has your best interests at heart. When I speak to our closest C-level marketers, they believe that Facebook delivers more than they take. That we are a culture of givers, and we simply care more about growing their business than any other partner. We led the industry to develop standards for measurement that could be used across media, and we have set ourselves apart from the noise about digital not being transparent." By January 2017, her optimism would resemble Voltaire's Dr. Pangloss. "This is the best of all possible worlds." As an avalanche of embarrassing Facebook and YouTube headlines stirred a massive backlash. Exposed was their reliance on automated machines to place ads on sites offensive to advertisers. Their platform's role in transporting unverified fake news, a cascade of new measurement mistakes, and stories about how their data might threaten user privacy. Advertisers cried foul and began to pull some of their ads. On stage at the June 2017 Cannes Lions Festival, Keith Weed complained that 60% of advertising online is directed to bots. "We want to buy the eyeballs of viewers, not bots," he said. Procter & Gamble's Mark Pritchard warned that his ad dollars would not be funneled to digital companies unless their advertising and brand safety was verified by independent measurement firms. Then, in the fall of 2017, Facebook embarrassingly disclosed that it had unknowingly accepted ads aimed at dividing Americans during the 2016 presidential campaign, ads that were paid for by a shady Russian company with Kremlin ties. The trust issue, which has hobbled relations between agencies and clients, now subverted Facebook and Google's relations with advertisers. Carolyn Everson and her Google counterparts made efforts to assuage advertisers. "But it was a serious setback for Facebook and Google," Kasson said as he looked back later in 2017. "Last year at Cannes, if you stood on the Croisset and looked at Duopoly Beach, Facebook and Google's popular cabanas on the beach, you would have thought they were impregnable. What we found out in this last cycle was that they were penetrable. Facebook has all the issues around measurement, and YouTube has all the issues around brand safety. In the upfronts this week, everybody's story was brand safety, brand safety." Why did Facebook and Google screw up? "It happens online because they don't have a filter," Kasson said. He went on to say of his mentee, Carolyn Everson, "She was affected profoundly. Carolyn is somebody who has a high standard. This impugns her integrity, and she's not comfortable with it, nor should she be. She knew advertisers and agencies were less trusting, more suspicious of Facebook." To gauge and defang the level of mistrust toward Facebook, Everson retained Kasson and MediaLink. She did lean on Kasson for advice, she says. And she goes out of her way to praise Mark Pritchard, a forceful critic of digital practices, who, she says, called on us to lead the way to clean up what he would call the digital swamp. Everson retains the humility to be a really good listener, which helps explain her ability to win over critics. Of Pritchard, she says, "He's been advising me. He's been a mentor to me." Yet by the fall of 2017, advertising clients still grumbled. In a presentation he made to an Advertising Week audience in September 2017, Keith Weed offered a report card to Facebook and digital companies. He gave them a mere C for ad fraud and an even harsher F for cross-platform transparency, insisting, "We've got to see over the walled gardens," and allow measurement companies to monitor and measure their claims. Everson knew another big challenge for Facebook in coming years was what she calls the regulatory environment globally. Beginning in the winter and spring of 2017, a chorus of critics weighed in against the digital giants, warning that governments must police companies like Facebook, Google, Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon because they threatened both competition and privacy. Data was the oil of the digital era, The Economist editorialized in May 2017. Old ways of thinking about competition, devised in the era of oil, look outdated in what has come to be called the data economy. Abundant data, they continued, alters the nature of competition, and companies with this data benefit from network effects. The data empowers Google to see what people search for, Facebook what they share, Amazon what they buy. They have the resources to erect barriers to entry by absorbing potential competitors. And their abundant data allows a peek into private lives, employing this information as a marketing tool. Apple raised its voice against Facebook and Google. With little reliance on advertising, in September 2017, Apple wielded privacy as a weapon against its digital competitors. For its upgraded Safari browser, Apple said it would limit how advertisers and websites could use cookies to track and target users. Apple was, once again, portraying itself as a company on the side of consumers and their privacy. Arrayed against Apple were the trade groups of the entire advertising universe, the Interactive Advertising Bureau, the ANA, and the 4As. In an open letter, they accused Apple of sabotage, insisting that the blocking of cookies could murder the advertising business. Governments were awakened. The European Union was questioning Facebook's privacy protections. The British government announced that it was weighing whether to demand that Facebook and Google delete personal information from their databanks. The Attorney General of Missouri announced an antitrust investigation of Google. The Australian, the Murdoch-owned national newspaper, revealed a 23-page Facebook presentation that offered advertisers the ability to target over 6 million Facebook users, some as young as 14, who have said in their posts that they felt worthless, insecure, defeated, and needed a boost. Facebook denied that it offered tools to advertisers to target emotionally vulnerable people. But Wired magazine exposed their misleading response when it noted that Facebook did not explain how the research on minors ended up in a presentation to potential advertisers. The FTC was urged to investigate Google's privacy policies. Convinced that Google was violating its antitrust laws by favoring sites it owned in its search results, the European Union wanted to inspect Google's crown jewel, its search algorithm, which was fiercely resisted as Google claimed it was an attempt to protect and strengthen European business competitors. By the summer of 2017, the EU announced it would impose a huge $2.7 billion fine on Google. Concerned with maintaining their political control, China and authoritarian governments on various continents had already sealed their borders to Facebook and Google. By early 2017, Arye Berkoff had unearthed a surprise buyer and was close to completing the sale of MediaLink. His pitch, he says, was simple. Michael Kasson sits at the epicenter of all that is going on in the advertising landscape. In an information and events-driven business, you want to drive more connectivity and brand awareness. Michael is a rare figure whose relationship acumen can really help to blow up awareness and help businesses and brands everywhere. It's a big day for us. It's a big day for everybody, Kasson said on February 7th, while standing in the open workspace at MediaLink, his staff arrayed in front of him, with the CEO of the company he would now report to, Duncan Painter of Essential, standing to his side. Essential is a public company in the UK that owns the Cannes Lions Festival, operates out of offices in 16 countries, and offers 19 different services and subscription products to businesses, including festivals and exhibitions and publications. With his booming voice amplified by a handheld wireless microphone, Kasson strode across the space in front of the windows, overlooking the Avenue of the Americas. Casually attired in a blue zippered sweater over an open-necked pale blue dress shirt and gray slacks, he came back to the center of the room to perch on a marble stool. Painter stood to his side in a charcoal gray suit, white shirt, and plain gray tie. This was an 8:30 a.m. staff announcement. The media would be served a press release and invited to speak to Kasson and Painter by phone afterward. "We want to help you expand globally," Painter affably said, speaking in a reassuring way. He was amazed, he said, to learn of the high regard clients had for you. "We see ourselves as enablers, and we are proud to make you our 20th brand." MediaLink served about 200-plus companies around the world, Painter said in the press release. "We serve 24,000, so we want to get MediaLink in with their business model through all the applicable businesses and clients that we work with." "What this means for everybody," Kasson said, "is that we'll expand our global footprint. We will open London and Hong Kong offices this year. Otherwise, things will stay the same." He said that he had signed a 4-year contract and that Wendy Millard had also signed a long-term contract. "The name on the door will still be MediaLink. There will just be more doors." He stressed their shared approach. Neutrality is a key focus of both businesses. Kasson and Painter later shared with the press for the first time that MediaLink's revenues reached $56 million in 2016, generating a profit of $14 million. the purchase price entailed a cash payment of $69 million, less than half the $150 million Kasson had guessed in June, but the purchase price would climb to $207 million over 3 years if MediaLink hit its targets. In truth, MediaLink was a relatively small company, as was Essential, its revenues just topping $300 million. Although Kasson told his staff MediaLink would still be an arm's-length partner with Cannes Lions, he expected we will expand what we do in Cannes. Just as they started an entertainment vertical in Cannes in 2016, inviting entertainment figures to speak, which was highlighted by an interview Kasson conducted with Les Moonves. Perhaps a sports vertical was next, he said. What Kasson didn't say that morning was that each of the 120 MediaLink employees would receive sizable bonuses, which came out of his and Wenda Millard's pocket from their 100% ownership of MediaLink. He also didn't announce this day that Wenda Millard would step aside as president, become vice chair, and move to London to open their office there and begin MediaLink's global expansion. The night before the announcement, Kasson took care to phone and alert 5 holding company CEOs: Maurice Levy of Publicis, John Wren of Omnicom, Michael Roth of IPG, Yannick Bellour of Havas, and Martin Sorrell of WPP. He told friends that 4 of the 5 were effusive in their congratulations and kudos. Martin just said thank you for the call. With Kasson and Sorrell secure in their roles, there should be lots of opportunities for these frenemies to interact over the next several years. 72 and still robust, Sorrell is unlikely to step down anytime soon. Lazard Vice Chairman Jeffrey Rosen, who was WPP's lead independent director and served on the board for almost 11 years until June 2015, and is an ardent admirer of Sorrell's, says the board's independent directors always thought about and discussed succession. Martin always hated discussing it because it was like discussing his own mortality. The board became much more systematic about it in 2010, and Martin started talking with us about succession formally once a year and informally more often. The chair of the WPP board, Roberto Quarta, publicly addressed the succession question in April 2016. Whether, in Sir Martin's case, that happens tomorrow, in 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years, or even over a longer period, we have already begun to identify internal and external candidates who should be considered. Could she imagine, Christiana Falcone was asked, her husband retired? No, she exclaimed, laughing hysterically. Can you imagine him in my kitchen putting knives and forks in order? I would have to outsource to a call center in India to call him all the time. Sorrell offered another version of his wife's response when asked about his future at WPP. I will stay here until they shoot me. Of course, the deft Sorrell might choose another way to exit. Several years ago, he did negotiate to sell WPP to Warren Buffett, but they did not see eye to eye on the price, and the discussions amicably collapsed. It is not inconceivable that consulting or software companies who are rumbling into the marketing space and have deep pockets could seek to acquire WPP. I'm making this up. I have no knowledge, Michael Kasson says. But if I'm Accenture or Adobe or Oracle, and I'm moving into that business and I have the market cap, why not buy it? One reason not to buy it was delivered in a July 2017 report by Brian Weiser of Pivotal. He was one of several analysts to downgrade the stocks of the advertising holding companies from buy to hold. He wrote, "It's a difficult time for the agency holding companies." He cited slow underlying business growth for core clients, zero-based budgeting at many of them, more aggressive procurement officers, client mistrust, new competitive threats, increasing reliance on automated machines, and evidence that the engines of their economic growth, the media agencies, were sputtering. In a fall analysis of the agency business, Weiser concluded, "Negative narratives toward agencies in general, and WPP in particular, are likely to continue for some time. Sorrell and his holding company compatriots were anxious. Worried about costs and unconvinced that advertising dollars equaled growth, clients, particularly consumer goods clients, who accounted for one-third of WPP's revenues, hacked away at their agency spending. Spurred by the ANA-sponsored investigation, mistrustful clients reopened agency contracts searching for loopholes. With growing political and economic volatility, most companies, including agencies, grew cautious. The holding companies altered their future public financial projections, from 2% or slightly higher overall growth to flat or barely above that in 2017 and maybe 2018. WPP's stock price, like that of the other holding companies, fell. It's a mistake to curb advertising spending because it assures growth, Sorrell warned. Our industry may be in danger of losing the plot. Whether slowed growth is temporary or not, agencies are destined to change. There is no way to know today if AT&T and McDonald's insistence on having a single large agency provide one-stop shopping will be the future model, or if David Droga is correct that a small agency like Droga 5 is less afraid of losing business and will thrive because he offers clients fearless independence. Our starting point is that clients pay us for our opinion, not to take dictation. But what if Bob Greenberg is right, and the agency model is really a dinosaur? During WPP's earnings call with analysts in August 2017, when Sorrell was asked about a drop-off in business, he said his company's first critical priority was to get its employees to work horizontally, offering integrated teams to better serve clients. Ben Thompson, who writes the acute Stratechery business blog, dismissed Sorrell's response as feeble because it assumed the main competitive threat was from rival agencies. But as advertising and marketing shifts to a plethora of digital platforms, Thompson wrote, the idea of agencies as the essential middleman, a one-stop shop for advertisers, fades into history. The internet ends the limited ad space of old media as online stores like Amazon offer unlimited shelf space. Distribution and transaction costs become zero, and the critical competency is discovery, where to find and target desired customers. At the same time, discovery on digital is monopolized by two companies, Facebook and Google. He overlooked emerging rival Amazon. Assuming that all media, old or new, will in the future be delivered digitally, the problem agencies haven't confronted, he concluded, is that their business model is obsolete. Since there are only two places an advertiser might want to buy ads, the fees paid to agencies become a lot harder to justify. Clients, he believes, will turn to Google and Facebook to serve as their media agency. Whether this analysis is correct or not, few question that the infrastructures of giant holding companies will have to be slimmed. Kasson says, I do not think it is deck chairs on the Titanic for the holding companies, but they have to end up with a smaller ship. Martin Sorrell, who is never passive, has begun to aggressively combine some of his agencies together, wringing costs out via consolidation. Further consolidation among the six holding companies is an expectation expressed by more than a few senior marketing executives. They expect there will be at least one marriage among the six, as there almost was when Omnicom and Publicis announced they would marry but broke up before the wedding. Speculation today usually centers on Dentsu, a company that lacks creative agencies, making a bid for, say, IPG. Or a deep-pocketed consultant company making an offer one of the holding companies can't refuse. Unquestionably, the importance of data to target consumers assures that media agencies will become more vital and that clients will insist that creative and media work more closely. And as media agencies become more central, as he nears 70, the advertising career of the Yoda of the media agency business, Kasson's closest friend, Erwin Gottlieb, is coming to a close. He has a daughter and grandchildren in California, and he's not happy with the poisonous mistrust enveloping the business. While relaxed in his 7th Avenue office, sipping an espresso in the summer of 2017, he said, "I was brought up in a business where you put your clients' interests first, your company's interests second, and your own personal interests third. Today's environment makes that kind of thinking naive." Told he sounded like he had one foot out the door, he declined to confirm or deny this. Further muddying the succession questions at WPP was the surprise departure in August 2017 of Brian Lesser, the North American CEO of Group M. The well-regarded Lesser, who assumed that role in 2016, was thought to be a potential successor to Gottlieb, and maybe one day to Sorrell. "He was very much on a fast track," Gottlieb says sadly. But he chose to become CEO of a new advertising and analytics division at AT&T, reporting directly to CEO Randall Stephenson. Why did Lesser leave? A senior WPP executive who asked not to be named traced the cause back to John Mandel's speech and the ANA investigation. "Many agency people are dispirited. They call us crooks. They say our people will go to jail. Yet no one has produced evidence to fault us on. It's really hard to come to work and put your clients' interests first. The long-term consequence is you lose good people." Brian is just the tip of the iceberg. Les Moonves' future at CBS seemed clearer. In May 2017, his CBS contract was extended another 2 years, to mid-2021, when he will be approaching his 72nd birthday. "I have not come up with anything I like better than what I'm doing now," he says, when asked what else he might like to do. "He loves going to the Super Bowl, but if I never go to another, I'm fine. I've done 25 Super Bowls, 25 Grammy Awards, 20 Kennedy Center Honors. I've seen most places in the world. No matter what happens, they can't take what I've accomplished away from me. I think my legacy's been established." What wasn't as clear was CBS's future. Believing content is king, Moonves had wanted to find a way to acquire the much larger Time Warner, but AT&T swooped in. "They would have been a good fit for us," he admits. He had always wanted to own a movie studio under the CBS umbrella, but now says owning a studio is not as glamorous. His eyes were fixed on owning a more profitable television production studio, which was the allure of Time Warner. This helps explain his ambivalence to heed the wishes of Shari Redstone, whose family's National Amusements owns 80% of the voting shares of both Viacom and CBS. Shari Redstone wanted the two companies to merge with Moonves as CEO. Viacom's Paramount Studio had faltered, as had MTV, and many of its cable channels, and she believed Moonves might remedy this. Publicly, in 2016, Moonves professed his reluctance and said he was not in a standoff with Redstone over whether he or she would control the board of the combined companies. Control was not a very large issue, he says. However, privately through his attorney Martin Lipton of Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz, Moonves did in fact demand control. A 3-page September 30, 2016 letter from Lipton to Redstone's attorney, Christopher E. Austin of Cleary, Gottlieb, Steen & Hamilton, declared, "An appropriate governance framework was critical if the two companies were to be united. Assurances were needed that the new management team will have complete and irrevocable authority to manage the combined businesses." The form of these assurances were contained in 9 demands Lipton attached to the last page. Instead of board control residing in the hands of Redstone, it specified that control would reside in the hands of independent directors, 3/4 of them truly independents, including the addition of all the current CBS directors. Redstone would appoint only 2 of the board members. And to remove Moonves, who would serve as both chairman and CEO, would require approval by 2/3 of the independent directors. Despite her eagerness to combine the companies and lure Moonves as CEO, Shari Redstone was not about to cede her voting control of the company, and the secret negotiations ended. With media consolidation a fact of life, AT&T buys first DirecTV and then Time Warner, Charter buys Time Warner Cable, Verizon buys AOL and then Yahoo, which it renames Oath, Time Inc. sought a buyer, MediaLink finds one, and even Rupert Murdoch announced the sale of parts of his company. Moonves acknowledged that tech and telephone companies were sniffing around content companies like CBS. In an interview with Bloomberg News in the spring of 2017, Verizon CEO Lowell McAdam publicly proclaimed that AT&T's buying into content has made people reevaluate their portfolio. He said he would be interested in a merger with CBS, Disney, or Comcast. But Moonves said he liked the hand he was holding. In a conference call with analysts, Moonves declared, "We've always said we are self-contained and we like our position." But Les Moonves has an ultimate boss, Shari Redstone, and she doesn't like his position. She is said to be convinced, as are members of the Viacom board, that Viacom lacks the resources to make bold acquisitions. Like others, they were stunned when Rupert Murdoch announced the sale in December 2017 of most of 21st Century Fox to Disney, claiming that Fox lacked scale. More troubling, they believe Viacom's financial growth has plateaued. She believes a marriage between the weaker Viacom and the more robust CBS offers potential financial salvation, and she wants Moonves to be in charge. But Redstone has told associates she would never give up her ownership control to Moonves or anyone else, and if Moonves persisted in his previous demands for absolute control of voting stock he did not own, in the future, she might replace him. It has long been a goal of Carolyn Everson's to one day be a CEO. Asked about this with a Facebook PR person in the room, she answers, "It's not a goal I think about now. I literally love what I'm doing. Maybe in 5 years." Asked the same question in the summer of 2017, without a Facebook colleague present, Everson candidly says, "I have a mixed answer to that question. Part of me feels as though I have the best job in the world working for a life-changing company and running revenue larger than many Fortune 500 companies. Another part of me says, is there another chapter for Carolyn Everson? I don't know." If she wants to get on the CEO track, then she has to step off the track she's on, her mentor, Michael Kassin, says. Sometimes she has to take a step back to take a step forward, meaning it is likely that before a CEO job would be offered, she would want to step out of her revenue-generating role and take another executive position. He cites the example of another mentee, Wendy Clark, who was once CMO of Coca-Cola. If she does well as CEO of DDB, she can be CEO of Coca-Cola. Michael Kassin confronts many looming questions. Is MediaLink a one-man shop, a company too dependent on his remarkable skills and relationships? Michael is unique, Maurice Levy says. The biggest challenge Michael will have is how to scale. MediaLink is a boutique of artisans, of craftsmen and craftswomen, and I don't know how many Michaels there are on Earth. Kassin demurs. Essential would not have spent so much money just for Kassin, he says. They saw a real team. We built an extraordinary team. We have over 100 clients today. As we've seen, the press release announcing the sale said 200. You think I could alone keep 100 clients happy? One of the individuals Kassin is banking on to play a huge future role in the growth of MediaLink is his first chief of staff, Grant Gitlin. Gitlin believes the resources of their new parent company will provide MediaLink with the scale it needs. There's a really good reason we should have been sold, he says. A service company our size lacks infrastructure. When purchased by a large company, we will benefit. 6 months after MediaLink announced its sale, Michael Kassin said of his corporate parent, "It's working out well. We have tremendous momentum. They're great partners and they are letting us run our own business." MediaLink's parent company hit some turbulence during the June 2017 Cannes Lions Festival. Offended by the steep costs and sometimes Babylonian excesses, Martin Sorrell slashed the number of WPP executives attending by half, to 500. He again claimed people feel ripped off by the festival, and said that in 2018 they would reevaluate coming to Cannes. Erwin Gottlieb chose not to attend in 2017. His room at the Carlton cost $2,500 a night, and he said he was required to pay for 10 nights even though he stayed fewer. This, and what he said was the total cost for room, food, travel, and entertainment, about $75,000, annoyed him. What outraged him was the inefficiency of what he called a boondoggle. The crowding is not conducive to getting business conducted. You can't get in or out of the lobby of the Carlton. What was once a celebration of creativity, he believed, had warped into a party. And he was upset that the $63 million the Lions hauled in this year and the money they generated from the 41,170 award entries made the largest award ceremony in our business and the most prestigious a for-profit event. I think as an industry we deserve a non-profit award, as is true of the Academy Awards, the Tonys, Grammys, or Emmys. Interestingly, he and Sorrell are not on the same page on the awards, for Sorrell says the primary value of Cannes for WPP is in the awards. Winning the awards is our number one objective, he declared, before WPP won Holding Company of the Year in 2017 for the seventh straight year. Maurice Levy's successor at Publicis, CEO Arthur Seydoun, also took a shot at the Cannes Lions. On the eve of the 2017 gathering, Seydoun announced that in 2018, none of his employees would attend Cannes or submit entries in any awards programs, and would engage in no other promotional events. Instead, he said, Publicis would invest the savings in Marcel, an internal tech platform connecting Publicis's 80,000 employees. It would, he hoped, transform their ability to collaborate. While many Publicis employees were surprised and upset by Seydoun's seemingly impulsive announcement, they weren't as concerned as Essential's team was. The stock market sent Essential's stock tumbling on the news. To prevent a fire from spreading, the festival hurriedly assembled a prestigious advisory committee that included Keith Weed and Mark Pritchard. There have been a lot of discussions this week about the structure of the festival, and we want to create the right Cannes Lions experience for all participants, said Philip Thomas, who had been promoted to CEO of Essential Events. Despite the criticism, festival revenues rose 7% in 2017. Nevertheless, this growth fell short of the 18% spurt for the festival in 2016. Michael Kasson stoutly defended his new corporate parent and the festival. In an op-ed commentary in Campaign US, an online advertising news publication, he implicitly rebuked his friend Erwin Gottlieb, not to mention Sorrell and Seydoun. The Cannes Lions, he wrote, was not a giant rosé-infused party. If you can't extract value from Cannes Lions, you aren't approaching it properly. And if you lost your compass because Cannes looks so different than it used to, that's because our industry is in the midst of transformation. The Cannes Lions has been reinvented the same way the industry is being reinvented. All good. It wasn't all good to Martin Sorrell. In the fall of 2017, he escalated his attack on the Cannes Lions. An enterprising Adweek reporter got hold of internal WPP emails from Sorrell demanding that they withdraw from Eurobest, an advertising conference put on by Essential. He also threatened, unless the Cannes Lions streamlined the Cannes conference and reduced costs, WPP might withdraw entirely. A decision would await a summit meeting between Sorrell and Essential's Duncan Painter. With agencies being squeezed by clients and competitors, Essential eased their financial burden by announcing major changes for the 2018 Cannes Festival. Instead of 8 days, the festival would conclude after 5. The number of rewards and thus submission costs would be reduced. Delegate passes, which had cost more than 4,000 euros, would be slashed to 900 euros. Working with the city of Caen, hotel prices would be frozen, and more than 50 restaurants would offer delegates less expensive fixed-price menus. A smiling Arthur Seydoun said Publicis would be happy to return in 2019, and Martin Sorrell said he was pleased. Essential had agreed to reduce some of what he considered bloated costs, but wanted to see additional changes he chose not to specify. And what about Michael Kassin's future? His attitude toward retirement was similar to Martin Sorrell's. "It will never happen," says his wife Ronnie. "He can't sit home. He needs to be doing something." In truth, Kassin was even more ebullient than normal. The sale of MediaLink lifted a giant burden from his shoulders. I caught a glimpse of that burden the first time I tried to quiz Kassin about his legal travails in California. He insisted he did not want me to record or take notes at this session. It was late in the fall of 2016, months before the 2017 sale of MediaLink. We were in his glassed office with the doors closed and no staff present. He asked that there be no phone call interruptions. Salads waited on the small round table in his office, but he did not eat. As he started recounting the events of 3 decades ago, he started to sob. He was speechless. With the All Good sign above his head, he confessed to being terribly self-conscious, not certain if people knew of his past and fearful that they did. Not having spoken of this in many years, this buoyant man found it hard to open up. We agreed to confront the subject on the record at a later date. If I wanted to raise it in an email, he asked that I send any communication on the matter to his personal Gmail so it would be private. In the course of interviews over the next few months, he relived what happened to him in California and its courts, his conviction for embezzlement, his suspension from the practice of law, and the California State Supreme Court's acknowledgement that he made a mistake but did not take money from investors to enrich himself, and his vindication in his battle with the State Bar of California. But always he wondered, did people know? Did they think he had been an embezzler? Did they whisper about his past? Some did. Michael Kassin embodies the contradictions of advertising. One senior marketing executive who knows him well confides after being promised anonymity. "Those in the business have no definable expertise. We're an insecure profession. Unlike lawyers or those in finance or journalism, we don't have advertising degrees. You make commercials and you're a star. Here we are in the middle of a kickback controversy with complaints about a lack of transparency, with the ANA hiring a detective agency to investigate, yet the industry is advised by a man who was once drummed out of business, disbarred for similar crimes." This executive did not know the specifics of Kassin's past, and much of what he thought he knew was dead wrong, but his whispers were exactly what aroused Michael Kassin's paranoia. Weeks after the February sale of MediaLink, Kassin sat at a corner table at Scalanatella and opened up about why he now felt relief. 2 weeks ago, I skied down the mountain in Deer Valley, and it's the first time I didn't have a rearview mirror in a long time. Essential looked at the record and said, "Okay." Kassin felt comfortable. He believed that Essential did their due diligence and concluded that MediaLink was not a one-man operation, that he had built a sturdy company. Humbly, he said, "It's easier to have this conversation today because of the sale. I needed the validation. It's emotional. Okay, take a breath." He took a sip from his dry martini and said he was fortified by the 4,000 supportive emails he received after the sale announcement. Before, whenever he thought of writing a book, the title he had in mind was Confessions of a Jewish Prince. Now it's No Rearview Mirror. He smiled broadly. This is Jonathan Todd Ross. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Frenemies, The Epic Disruption of the Ad Business and Everything Else by Ken Auletta. This program was directed by Lewis Milgram. Executive producer Nick Martorelli. Text copyright 2018 by Ken Auletta. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.